Good evening, and welcome to Teaching Cases from Investigators, the application of available research to the clinical care of patients with hepatocellular carcinoma. I'll be moderating. I'm Fred Divers from Arkansas. This is our esteemed faculty today. We have Dr. Anthony L. Curey. He's at the USC Norris Comprehensive Cancer Center in Los Angeles. On his right, Dr. Richard Finn, at the Johnson Comprehensive Cancer Center at UCLA, also in Los Angeles. Our thoughts are with you guys with all the wildfires. Dr. Ruth He, from the Lombardi Comprehensive Cancer Center at Georgetown University in Washington, and Dr. Stacy Stein from Rutgers Cancer Institute in New Jersey. These are the disclosures of our faculty and moderator. This activity is supported by educational grants from AstraZeneca and Pharmaceuticals LP and Eisai. The research to practice CME planning committee members, staff, and reviewers do not have any specific conflicts of interest here. I'd like to point out this is an educational activity that does contain discussions of non-FDA-approved uses of agents and regimens, and we'd ask that you please refer to the official prescribing information for each of these products and their approved indications in their package inserts. We do have some consulting faculty here today, and these guys are going to, Dr. Love has done interviews with this consulting faculty, and these will come up as clinical videos and vignettes moderated by Dr. Love. We have Dr. Abu Alpha from Memorial and Dr. Thomas Abrams from the Dana-Farber, and Katie Kelly will be joining from University of California at San Francisco. So this is where we're going to be going. We have four modules today, and like all research to practice programs, we aim to stay on target and time. So module one, we will be discussing the adjuvant systemic therapy for early stage hepatocellular carcinoma. Anthony will lead the discussion there. Module two will be recent developments in the management of intermediate stage hepatocellular carcinoma. So this will obviously be discussing the role of TACE in systemic therapy. Dr. He will discuss current first-line therapy for advanced hepatocellular carcinoma, and so some intriguing trials there and decision making. And finally, we'll look at promising investigational frontline strategies for advanced hepatocellular carcinoma. How do we select and sequence these therapies for the relapsed and refractory patients as well? That's always a big question for us in the community, and Dr. Stein will be in charge of module number four. We'll have some periodic questions for our esteemed faculty in between the clinical vignettes. So let's get started with module number one. Dr. Curey.
All right, thank you. Welcome, everybody. So I'll be talking about adjuvant systemic therapy for early stage hepatocellular carcinoma. So as a reminder, surgical resection continues to be an essential curative option for liver-limited hepatocellular carcinoma. When we think about it in BCLC staging terms, it's mostly applicable to BCLC stage 0 and A disease, because in the US, the trend is to mostly resect single nodules without vascular invasion. Now, that practice is variable across the world, where in some places there's more aggressiveness with resection, including resecting multifocal nodules and peripheral vascular invasion as well. Now, so the definition of resectability is highly variable. The challenge here is that there are high recurrence rates, as high as 70% at 5 years. The majority of the recurrences are in the liver. And there is a bimodal pattern of recurrence. So there is an early recurrence within 2 years, and there are some patterns that have been associated with that, bigger size than 5 centimeters, high grade, and presence of microvascular invasion. And then there's a later recurrence beyond 2 years that's more associated with advanced cirrhosis, multinodular disease at baseline, increasing age, male gender, and high AST levels. Now, there is a theory also, or a hypothesis, that some of the later recurrences may be new de novo lesions originating in the liver that's cirrhotic. The 5-year overall survival rates, depending on the series or study you look at, range between 45 and 75%. There's been multiple normograms developed to assess the risk of recurrence. This is one of the later ones that I chose to share today. And there is this early recurrence score that's developed based on data from over 2,300 patients over many years. And six variables were popped out as essential for this recurrence score, including AFP, size, multifocality, presence of satellite nodules, vascular invasion, and surgical margin positivity. Now, among these, AFP was the strongest predictor and worth 3 points out of these 11 total points. An important thing to note is that early recurrence has been associated with worse outcomes across multiple series. So patients who have early recurrence tend to have lower survival. Now, based on this, there is a huge motivation to identify an adjuvant therapy that's effective that lower recurrence rates. So the first attempt was, well, one of the first attempts was with the STORM trial looking at sorafenib. So in this trial, patients who underwent surgical resection or local ablation were randomized to sorafenib versus placebo. The study allowed intermediate and high-risk disease, and the definition is here in the table, so I won't go through it at this point. But the bottom line, there was no difference in recurrence-free survival with sorafenib compared to placebo. You see that the median recurrence survival was over 30 months in both arms. Another study that came after that, and actually it's being updated at this meeting, at this ASCO GI 2025, from mostly Korea, is looking at cytokine-induced killer cells. So these are autologous cells that were expanded ex vivo and then reinfused post-resection to patients. And you see that patients who received these cells had superior recurrence-free survival and overall survival. And the updated data at this meeting, you will see that seems to still validate the same results. Then, what about immunotherapy, right? We've seen immunotherapy combinations make a huge difference in the advanced disease setting, so it was natural for this to be evaluated in the adjuvant setting. The first evaluation was for atezo-bev in IMbrave 050. So these are patients with high risk of recurrence, and I'll go through how that was defined, that post-resection were assigned to atezo-bev or surveillance. A cycle of adjuvant taste was allowed because this is the practice in China, so this is only to accommodate the practice there, and the primary endpoint was recurrence-free survival. So the high-risk features were tumor greater than 5 centimeters, more than 3 tumors, microvascular invasion, peripheral vascular invasion, so VP1 or VP2, this is on imaging, or grade 3 or 4 differentiation. And the study, again, had a primary endpoint of recurrence-free survival. There was an interim analysis, which led to the initial release of results and then a follow-up analysis. OS would be analyzed if the RFS was positive. So these are the baseline characteristics, which were well-balanced across both arms. You can see that the majority of the patients had BCLCA disease, so over 80%. And the majority had one tumor, over 90%, and more than 50% had tumors greater than 5 centimeters. So this is the initial result that showed at 12-month RFS being superior for the atezo-bev arm at 78% versus 65% in the control arm. And this was with a hazard ratio of 0.72, confidence interval not crossing the boundary of 1. So this was, by the design and statistics of the trial, considered positive. There were some concerns at that point that the follow-up was short and that the curves were coming back together. So what happened with longer follow-up, I'll show you shortly. This is the initial OS data, which was highly immature. And the only point I want to remind you of on this slide is that 61% of the patients on the control arm were able to cross over and get a atezo-bev by design. So this is now the later follow-up. So the early recurrence-free survival benefit was not maintained on longer follow-up. You see that these curves really came back together with a longer median follow-up of 35 months. and the hazard ratio is now 0.90, and it's not statistically significant. So with longer follow-up, the RFS benefit is lost. And this is the updated overall survival data, which remains immature, but really these curves seem to overlap at this point. So the other thing is looking at patterns of recurrence from this trial, because there's a lot of learning that can be done, is that the majority of the patients recurred within the liver. The majority of patients recurred within Milan criteria, so which allows them to be salvaged potentially with transplant. And the majority of the recurrences were unilobar. Now, this is the safety summary, high level, but a quick reminder that on the experimental arm, there were more serious adverse events, including treatment-related serious adverse events, and numerically more death on that arm, and certainly higher grade 3 and 4 adverse events. So in the setting of the negative clinical data, the risk-benefit ratio now is not really favorable anymore for this adjuvant therapy. And based on this, there was this investigator or physician letter released saying there's unfavorable benefit risk for atezobev as an adjuvant therapy for HCC patients. There are several other pending adjuvant trials with single-agent PD-1, with combinations of a TKI with a PD-1, as well as Durva-Bev and Durva-Tremi, so we look forward to those results. Now, are we limited to adjuvant therapy? I think there is a big emerging role for neoadjuvant approaches. There are potential advantages to neoadjuvant therapy. They include the fact that there is a more intact anti-cancer immunity at that stage. You can use the tumor as a source of neoantigens if the patient is responding. So it's like in situ vaccination almost. The ability to assess response and test the biology, and it's a critical resource for biomarker development. In melanoma, there was a large study showing a benefit of giving neoadjuvant pembrolizumab or perioperative neoadjuvant-adjuvant versus adjuvant only. So based on this, there's been a slew of small studies, mostly single institution, looking at various regimen in the neoadjuvant setting, single agent PD-1, PD-1 with TKI, PD-1 with CTLA-4. Problem here is they had variable endpoints, different eligibility, but there is an emerging signal of 20 to 30% major to complete pathologic response. So I'll fly through the next few slides. This is the data with a single agent PD-1, cemiplimab. 20 out of 21 underwent surgery, 4 out of 20 had major pathologic response. This is data with neoadjuvant Nivo or Nivo-Ipi, small study as well. 20 out of 27 were able to undergo surgery with 30% major pathologic response. And the majority of the responders have not recurred. And then lastly, this is a slightly different study with Nivo-Cabo. These were patients who were really not resectable or borderline resectable, and 12 out of 15 achieved successful margin negative resection with 5 out of 15 major or complete pathologic response. So in summary, resection is an important curative modality. Recurrence rates are high. We don't have positive data in the adjuvant setting at this point, so adjuvant atezobev is negative. Results from other trials are pending, and the neoadjuvant approach is promising but needs further evaluation. Thank you.
Thank you, Anthony. We'll now be seeing some video cases and questions for the faculty.
Good evening, everyone. I'm medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love from Research to Practice. And to enhance this educational experience, I recently met with three clinical investigators, Drs. Ghassan Abu Alfa, Tom Abrams, and Katie Kelly, to plan this session and provide interesting cases from their practices for discussion. To begin, Dr. Kelly presents a young man with localized disease.
38-year-old with hepatitis B virus, HCC, completely preserved liver function, very healthy, who developed, unfortunately, a multifocal HCC, so two lesions, and an AFP of 70,000. So an extremely poor prognostic factor, AFP value, and the multifocality was also worrisome. He underwent resection, and the AFP came down to single digits after the resection. And the tumors, we think, might have been two separate primaries because they had slightly different genetic profiles. So given the AFP and given his young age and good health, I gave him a year's worth of adjuvant atezo-bev, which he has tolerated beautifully and has now completed without any signs of recurrence now around a little over a year.
Any data using cell-free DNA in the adjuvant HCC setting?
There are some data in the advanced setting, and then I believe that we can expect some data from IMbrave 050 in the near future, hopefully near future. I think it would be interesting to know if any of the experts at your session are using Signatera or a cell-free DNA assay in the adjuvant recurrence prediction setting, and would they use it to make an adjuvant therapy decision, even in light of the IMbrave 050 data?
If you had a situation where it was a much larger tumor than you knew about and the operation was not able to remove the entire tumor, you're left with the residual disease, I think that's a clear-cut case where you would then offer. I think the borderline cases are where there's high-risk features, microvascular involvement, macrovascular involvement, nodal disease.
Okay, some questions for the faculty. Anthony, in what non-protocol situations do you think, if any, that you would utilize the adjuvant systemic treatment from the IMbrave study for hepatocellular carcinoma patient now that we have follow-up data that shows those curves coming together? You know, Katie showed impressive data maybe in that individual case, and so in practice we're all sort of forced to make some clinical decisions. So this is where we put you in the hot seat. Can you tell us a case where you'd say, that was really high risk in the tumor she proposed with a high AFP and multifocal extensive disease?
Yeah. I mean, my short answer, currently in a non-protocol situation, I would not give adjuvant therapy. However, I would be a lot more cautious about selecting patients for resection, right? Think about the risk, the prognosis, and tailor the approach according to the risk up front. And I think if there are new adjuvant protocols accessible, I think enrollment in those would be very reasonable.
They brought up MRD testing. So we have Signatera in the colorectal case because you have a lot of post-transcriptional modification of the DNA. And so that was kind of the poster child for when a bespoke MRD model might be helpful. What do you guys think about cell-free DNA? Richard, thoughts?
Yeah, I think there's two ways that could be looked at. You know, one is identifying the patient at high risk for recurrence. And I think part of the failure with IMbrave 050 and STORM, and you commented, Anthony, recurrence-free survival is 33 months. That's not a high-risk patient, right? And the fact that the 050 curves do initially separate suggests that there probably is a group of patients that benefit, right? Those early relapsers, and retrospectively they showed maybe it was beyond up to 7, but that's retrospective. Maybe it would be patients who have cell-free DNA after surgery. Maybe they're the ones that should be focused on. I think we need to refine who those patients are. I mean, as far as doing that routinely, I do not. And I wrestle with this, and I ask my colleagues with things like Signatera. So you do a CT scan on a patient, they have no measurable disease, but their Signatera is high. I mean, how does that help you? I mean, other than cause a lot of stress and anxiety. Similar to AFP starts going.
Right, that was the next question. What about AFP if, you know, if the AFP doesn't come down, you know, to undetectable levels like she brought up? I mean, would you act upon that with no measurable disease on imaging?
Personally, I would wait till they develop recurrence because you're locked into an indefinite course of therapy. And in Katie's case, it was a 30-year-old person.
Right. Anthony, we're going to get data from IMbrave about this MRD testing here, do we think?
I hope so, but I you know, I don't know at this point.
Got it.
That's your answer. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead, Stacey. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, I just wanted to bring up, you know, just one point about this is that I think it will be important to recognize, identify high-risk patients, but I think the thing we don't really know in HCC is when there's no measurable disease, are these drugs effective? You know, in the same way that they are when there is measurable disease, meaning even if you could identify high-risk patients or be able to say that their ctDNA is positive or that the AFP did not normalize, right? What is the mechanism of, you know, clearing those cells? Just because there's positive data in other diseases, we certainly know as GI medical oncologists that the same data in other diseases, let's say like melanoma, don't necessarily translate into the cancers that we treat. So I think all of this research is really important, but I think until we see it in a randomized, you know, trial of actually showing in those groups that there's a difference in outcome, we won't really know the utility.
Yeah, it's an intriguing question. We obviously want to borrow information from other disease states and apply it here, and sometimes we get in trouble. We're going to look at a next clinical vignette at this point.
Neoadjuvant treatment is still something that, even though many of the studies have not really shown a whole lot of survival advantage for patients, I do think it makes sense for trying to convert patients from maybe a borderline resectable situation or unresectable to resectable, where we know that if we just do an operation and do nothing else, then this patient's going to have a very, very high risk of recurrence. So I would ask the faculty, you know, when they see a patient with a really large HCC with, you know, possibly some vascular invasion, are they thinking operation? Or are they saying, is this a palliative case? I think it makes sense for a patient who has what would be considered potentially to be incurable disease to start out with systemic therapy and, you know, with the hope that you could potentially render them resectable with a good response.
Dr. He, you're going to be talking to us about first-line therapy. You know, Anthony brought up how important it is to really risk stratify these people at the time of surgery. So what are your thoughts about neoadjuvant therapy in these situations? We have small data, but would you apply some principles from the metastatic setting here for these borderline resectable patients? Could you give us some thoughts there?
So those borderline resectable patients, they are really truly intermediate stage HCC. So I would use the strategy I think Richard is going to talk about, and intermediate stage disease with treatment, transarterial therapy, plus minus immunotherapy, really lower the oncological risk before I consider a curative option.
Perfect. So Richard, I don't want to steal your thunder before your talk, but can you kind of give us some highlights about your clinical experience with this strategy for borderline resectable patients and how you combine systemic and...
You know, I think the field has changed because we now have medical drugs, systemic treatments that are active, right? Before we had sorafenib, you know, no objective response rate, lenvatinib, objective response rate, but not quick and robust like we see with the IO regimen, single agent, and even increased with the doublets. And, you know, given the only way to cure patients with this disease is with surgery, we know that, as Anthony commented, most patients will recur. And even for someone who's borderline, the best chance of getting them to a resectability is probably now with medical treatment. You know, I have a guy who I've been following for some time, 15-centimeter HCC, has been on atezo-bev for about a year. We keep saying, oh, we'll send you to surgery, but every time we image him, he keeps getting smaller. And now he's like in the range of ablation maybe, and when we stop, I don't think is clear. This isn't neoadjuvant in that you give it for a fixed period of time and then you do something. This is more, in my practice, treat to best response and then see what else we can do.
So like in the pancreatic space, try to pick the winners early on, right? So if you're responding. Stacey, what are your thoughts about, I mean, does pseudoprogression come into play here? You know, if we're going to use some neoadjuvant therapy and you may see some of this, if you're thinking about getting to surgery, does that complicate matters?
So I have to say, I don't think I've actually ever seen a real case of pseudoprogression. I don't know if anyone else has. I know we like to talk about it, and you know, but I think usually if it looks like progression, it's progression. I would just say, though, I think, you know, these questions in particular really highlight the importance of multidisciplinary discussion in this disease, because there's a lot of situations like these patients that if someone went right to surgery and was never brought to tumor board, right, a medical oncologist would not actually be part of the patient's care or discussion. So I think every new patient, you know, really benefits from everyone at the table thinking about their case.
And speaking of multidisciplinary approaches, Dr. Abu Alfa is going to present the next clinical vignette for us here with a patient who has tumor thrombus extending into the right atrium.
This is a man in good performance, coming with really some abdominal pain and now with a concern for a liver mass. You can see that this liver mass is quite gigantic. This liver mass is filling in most of the right liver. But more importantly, the arrow is showing actually an extension of this mass that really traveling all the way to the heart, as we can see on the CT scan at the bottom as well. That tumor actually literally was sitting in the right atrium per se. And so we did a CT-guided liver biopsy. We did confirm that it is Hepatocellular carcinoma. We can imagine ourselves thinking like from a surgical intervention. On the other hand, can we consider that we should do rather systemic therapy because, quote unquote, this is metastatic disease in a way? Or also, shall we consider a combination of being between a local approach and the systemic approach?
I see you gave this patient the STRIDE regimen of durvalumab, tremelimumab. What happened?
The AFP was not really drastic to begin with. The 350 is not really a high AFP in reference, but you can see this AFP dropped all the way to zero. And this is incredible. The patient responded incredibly well. As you see, also his LFTs did improve with timing. And if anything, it really settled, knowing that really the disease became well under control. The tumor is definitely smaller. The patient's doing amazingly well clinically. And as you can see here at 3 months, and we have, I think, imaging also at 6 months, and the patient's totally functional still, still on therapy for close to 2 years and still doing very well. And this is a great question for the faculty to ask, would you consider a surgery now or local therapy?
So obviously, amazing response in this case. It's kind of one of those stories you run around and show all of your colleagues. Anthony, what are your thoughts about how you might manage this patient initially?
So initially, this patient has a very large infiltrative appearing tumor with major vascular invasion. So systemic therapy is where the level one evidence is. So I would do the same. I would do systemic therapy.
Perfect. So we have a question from the audience, which I thought is a great question here. In the world of non-small cell lung cancer, we would always be hesitant to start systemic therapy until we had an NGS biomarker panel. What is the role in hepatocellular carcinoma in making decisions for these patients on systemic therapy? Stacy?
Unfortunately, it's...
You were the closest.
Yeah, it's zero right now. There are different research protocols that are looking at NGS testing, and sometimes we do it for patients when something seems atypical or there's a mixed tumor, but really it's not part of, standard of care treatment at this time. And all the regimens that we're going to be discussing, this evening, none of them are based on, mutational testing, so we're not there.
And we'll get into how do you choose, these patients, whether you go STRIDE or other, obviously risk factors from the patient's comorbidities that play a lot into that. Dr. He, do you have any tricks for vascular invasion extension to the heart here when we talk about multimodality therapy?
I think currently I would just try to combination systemic therapy.
And then see what the response. What about, this question came in from the audience as well. What would the, let's say you had a great response and the patient went to resection. What's the role of adjuvant chemoembolization or radioembolization for these patients, particularly taking into account vascular invasion issues? Richard, you got thoughts?
Yeah, so, I would extrapolate from the melanoma data, given there's no strong evidence in liver cancer, but I have had patients. I have this exact patient who I met at ASCO 2020. I was at this ASCO GI meeting. Someone called me. Guy had a tumor in the heart. He's alive 5 years. He's been on Lenpembro for 5 years, high quality of life. Amazing response, like Gassan's patient. But for those patients who have gotten, in the modern age, atezo-bev, had a good response, then we've done either Y90 or a resection in some cases, I say, let's do another 6 months, and then we'll stop and see how you do. Because again, can we cure some of these patients?
I think you're reading the audience questions, Richard, because the next question was, if you have a great response to atezo-bev, how long would you continue that post-definitive therapy?
I mean, that's a little different. I mean, if it's someone who's not going to go for a procedure, it's kind of an indefinite buy-in, you know, and if it's not broken, I tend not to try to fix it. I talk to my melanoma colleagues and a different disease, they can stop after 3 years and just wait and see what happens, or 2.5 years. But I generally have patients who, if they're doing well and there isn't an opportunity for a consolidative procedure, I just let them go as long as there's no toxicity.
And just continue the regimen. Anthony, what are your thoughts about how you pick which one to start? Let's say this guy walked in. Would you pick the Strat or would you pick atezolizumab?
Well, I don't think we have data to decide and choose between the two, right? At this point, they've never been compared head-to-head, and I think they're both effective. I mean, they both would be appropriate here. I do think that patients with major vascular invasions have a slightly higher risk of bleeding. But again, those were not excluded from the IMbrave trial from atezo-bev, and they still did okay. So it's just something to keep in mind.
Do you think that the need to get an EGD and rule out variceal issues is an impediment to the utilization of that for a very high-risk patient? Or would you ever consider a TKI, which may have a sooner onset of action up front for this?
So, two questions, I guess, you asked. So, the EGD, I think it depends on the practice setting, but it is important to do it at this point before giving atezo-bev. The TKIs, I think the median time to response with TKIs, if there's going to be a response, is actually slower than with the IO combinations.
Perfect. Okay, on to module two. Okay, recent developments in the management of intermediate stage hepatocellular carcinoma. Richard, it's your show.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here. So when we're talking about intermediate liver cancer, we're talking about the Barcelona stage B here, coming from the recent iteration from a few years back. And this is a group of patients who have well-compensated liver disease that's multinodular and confined to the liver. They don't have vascular invasion. And these patients historically have been given local regional treatments, and that is TACE. Now, why is TACE there? Well, all of the recommendations in the guidelines should be data-driven, hopefully by level one evidence. And these are the two pivotal studies that go back now 20 years probably that looked at chemoembolization versus best supportive care. So essentially, you know, one arm didn't get any treatment, recognizing that there wasn't a lot to do for these patients. And both of these studies did show very similar results, given they were relatively small, 80 patients in the European study, 112 patients in Asia, or vice versa, I should say. But both of them showed a benefit to chemoembolization versus supportive care. Now, these studies were followed up by a meta-analysis of a number of studies over time. And again, in this meta-analysis, there was a confirmed benefit to chemoembolization in intermediate liver cancer. Now, it's important to look a little closely at these studies, because what had happened from 2002 until 2008 and even beyond, when we didn't have systemic treatment, chemoembolization filled a void. We could do it, right? Interventional radiologists would do it on patients with multifocal, bilobar disease, vascular invasion, even in some settings, patients with metastatic disease. But, you know, these two clinical studies used a very well-controlled cohort. You know, in the European study, the median size of the tumor was about 5 centimeters, mostly unilobular. And if you look at the Asian study, you can see that size is important for survival. Those with larger tumors, their survival was 11 months versus 30 months for the smaller tumors, and that being under 5 centimeters. So there are important prognostic factors for patients with intermediate disease. And there's been a lot of work to try to understand how do we identify the patients who do better with chemoembolization. And this becomes an even more important question in the modern age, where we now have drugs, the regimens we were talking about, that are very active. They improve survival, but they also have fairly high objective response rates. So one metric that's been put out there is the up to 7 criteria. This takes the size of your largest tumor plus the number of tumors and comes up with beyond up to 7. And it's in this substratification of the Bs from B1 to B4 that they really suggest that for some patients who are beyond up to 7, these B2s or B3s, maybe they're better off with medical treatment. Similarly, this paper that came out a few years ago developed a nomogram based on size of tumors, numbers of tumors, that again is prognostic for survival. And you could argue that if a patient is going to have such a bad survival with chemoembolization, maybe something else should be done. Now, I mention radioembolization here, even though it's not in the guideline, because globally, there's never been a large phase 3 study that has shown that TARE is superior to TACE. And globally, TACE is still the standard. This was a relatively small study. You can see 38, 34 patients per arm. It was actually stopped early because there was a very strong trend to superiority for Y90 over TACE. Now, this has not changed guidelines, but I'll tell you, in the United States, Y90 has largely replaced TACE, certainly at my institution, and I suspect my colleagues as well. With that being said, now that we have active drugs, there's a strong interest in moving them into intermediate disease. One of the ways of doing that is to combine it with local regional treatment and therefore TACE. So the first study to read out, and this was published actually just last week, the EMERALD-1 study, really was aimed at looking at durvalumab plus TACE and durvalumab bevacizumab versus placebo and TACE. The primary endpoint, though, were the combinations. It's important to keep in mind, in this study, first patients got IO and TACE, and when they were done with the TACE, they then went on to either receive placebo and durva, placebo alone, or bevacizumab. The bevacizumab was started after the TACE, and that might be an important thing to keep in mind. And here you see that schema. You know, the first part, patients got TACE with their medical treatment, and then once they completed their TACE, they went on to receive bevacizumab. The study was well balanced. Majority of patients had deadbeat TACE versus conventional TACE. All etiologies of liver cancer were represented. Most of these patients were Barcelona stage A or B. There were some with advanced disease because this study did allow portal venous invasion if it was local branch, V1 or V2. And keep in mind, in the guidelines, that is technically advanced liver cancer. So this study met its primary endpoint of improving PFS. You can see here, PFS went from 8 months to 15 months with a hazard ratio of 0.77. The curves separate a little late, but then remain separated during follow-up. And this was consistent across subgroups, including tumor burden. You see highlighted here those within or without up to 7 criteria received a similar benefit. Objective response rate with durva and bev was higher than placebo and TACE alone, 44%. And the durva TACE arm was very similar. And I should mention, because it was before, these patients did need an upper endoscopy before being treated with bev, as is standard. There were more adverse events with the systemic treatment, not surprisingly, than with TACE alone, but really no surprises here from what we've seen with IO and bev. The companion study, which was also published last week, both of these in Lancet with an associated editorial, looked at the small molecule lenvatinib in combination with pembrolizumab. We know that len and pembro from phase 1b and even in a phase 3 study had significant response rates, although it did not succeed in the advanced setting of len pembro versus len and placebo. This study started the len and pembro actually before the TACE. And there's some reason to think that having VEGF blockade on board before going ahead with an embolic procedure may be important. Similarly, this study was well-balanced, a global population. All etiologies of liver cancer were represented here. And here, they used a tumor burden score, less than 6, 6 to 12, or greater than 12. And the majority of these patients were in the 6 to 12 range. So this study also improved PFS, has a ratio of 0.66. These curves separated a little earlier and similarly remain separated with PFS going from 10 to 14.6 months. Again, this was consistent regardless of tumor burden or etiology and subgroups. And the LEAP study did show some early survival data. This data is still immature. It takes time to have survival events. We did not see that with the EMERALD study yet. But here you see a trend with a hazard ratio of 0.8 that still is not statistically significant, but also a small number of events. So we will wait to see follow-up on this. Objective response, similar to EMERALD, 43.5% increased over TACE alone. And the adverse events with Len-Pembro are very much dominated by the lenvatinib. Hypertension, proteinuria, enzyme changes, which could come from both, or thyroid problems, but really no new toxicities here. Now, I want to just remind you that in the modern iteration of the BCLC, they also have a group of intermediate patients who should be considered for systemic treatment up front. And this is driven by the fact that these tumor characteristics are associated with poor outcomes with local regional treatment alone. And here is a imaging and a cartoon of what these tumors might look like. We know that these patients with infiltrative, large tumor burden, even though they might be Barcelona B, confined to the liver, no vascular invasion, they're not going to do well with local regional treatment. And if you look at the subgroup of Barcelona Bs that were included in IMbrave 150, these are patients who either progressed on TACE or were those patients who were not candidates. You can see their survival was about 26 months. PFS of 12.5 months, not too dissimilar from the PFS we saw from EMERALD 1 and the LEAP 012 study. And objective response rate, 44%. The same objective response we saw with TACE and IO. And I put this out there to be a little provocative about, you know, do you really need the TACE? And there's ongoing studies to answer that question. These are studies looking at patients with systemic treatment versus local regional treatment. A very important academic question, how well these will succeed now that we have EMERALD 1 and LEAP, which kind of give us an answer, might make accrual to these a challenge. But in closing, local regional treatment is the standard of care here. Globally, it's TACE, increasingly Y90 in the U.S. Keep in mind, these aren't curative treatments. LRT is not curative. And we now have very active systemic treatments. And in some patients, you know, they might do better with medical treatment up front. But that's going to be reassessed now that we have these combination studies. But keep in mind, you get started on a combination study, you're on treatment until you progress. This is not an adjuvant study where you take it for a year and stop. And then what do we do when you do progress? So that is why the overall survival data is so important to see. Thank you.
That was great. Thank you so much. So we have some additional video cases and questions from the faculty, from Dr. Abrams and Dr. Kata Kelly.
EMERALD was durvalumab, Bev, and TACE for unresectable HCC. And it did show an improvement in PFS versus TACE alone. I think it's a reasonable thing to try for patients with unresectable disease. Certainly, it seems like something that there's been good responses to. So I'd be interested to know if people have used it. And if so, you know, what their experience has been with it. I personally have gotten a little bit away from local therapies up front, given the fact that we have systemic therapies that are far more successful than they once were. And I'd be interested to know what the faculty thinks about that.
The LEAP 012 study did show improvement in progression-free survival. It does not have mature survival data yet and did not have a significantly higher response rate. So I'm definitely eager to see more follow-up data from that study.
Okay, we have a few minutes for discussion. I think this brings up some intriguing points. I guess at first I'm going to go down the row and just ask everybody. So, Anthony, have you used TACE in combination with systemic therapy in your clinical practice off protocol?
Not the way it was done in EMERALD or LEAP 012. I've done a systemic therapy first, and then if patients are having a good response and And I can augment it with liver-directed therapy. So a slightly different approach.
No, that's that you led into that well, because I think whether you start with systemic therapy and then add it, those lines get blurred, right? You know, whether you're... What about you, Dr. Heap? Thoughts about, have you used the systemic therapy in combination with TACE-OFF protocol?
I have, in most cases, I have not. And I think if you look at the EMERALD-1 study inclusion criteria, I think a lot of those patients have probably will start with systemic therapy. But if patient has a solitary tumor, those patients gets TACE treatment. I'll watch for response before I would consider systemic therapy.
Stacy, you're going to talk about TKIs and sequencing them later. If you did see a patient and you were considering combined systemic therapy and TACE, how would you choose between the EMERALD data and the LEAP data if you chose to go down that path?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I would say, you know, just one thing about this topic in general is that the truth is we really work in a multidisciplinary group. And so I think we have to identify the fact that there are other people at the multidisciplinary team that may feel strongly about adding local therapy, even when we say, let's start with systemic therapy for this. So just to put that out there, I think that's often how we're not really doing things exactly by the trial, but somehow the patient winds up getting local therapy and then systemic therapy. But, you know, in terms of EMERALD or LEAP, I think we really need to see the overall survival data. I mean, in general, I probably would think more about the first line therapies that we use now that don't include a TKI. And so I guess my bias is to think more of the EMERALD regimen. But the truth is, I think until we see the longer term data from both of these studies, we don't really know.
So, Dr. Finn, this data was in combination with TACE or chemoembolization. Do you have clinical experience or thoughts or comments about utilizing this with radioembolization? As you mentioned, Y90 has kind of become the de facto standard in yours and your colleagues' institutions.
Yeah, that's a very important question. I mean, one of the issues that I think Stacy is alluding to is also, you know, are we just using systemic treatment earlier and delaying it till they naturally progress, and maybe overall survival will be the same at the end of the day, right? We'll end up at the same place. And that's with the TACE data. With Y90, I don't know that we can naturally assume that there's synergy between systemic treatment and Y90. And it's possible that if you did Y90 and waited till they progress and then, you know, gave them systemic treatment, again, you'll end up at the same spot. And by delaying the systemic treatment, you're sparing patients toxicity and cost. You know, I think in some patients, you know, that might be going to transplant, right? Maybe it would be reasonable to use this type of regimen with Y90 to keep them on the list longer so they don't progress, right? That is one area that might be important for this type of approach. But the bottom answer for Y90, I don't know if we'll just plug it in. That will be something that we'll have to figure out.
Before we move to our next vignette, when do you guys expect mature survival data from EMERALD-1 and LEAP so that we can feel more confident using this in the clinical practice where I might live?
Is that for me?
Yes.
Are you saying when do we expect it? I wish I could guess, you know, because it's event-driven. But usually in this disease stage, I think it will be years. It's not a few months.
Okay. Yeah. Perfect. All right, moving on. We have Katie Kelly with another video for us to discuss systemic treatment.
What about patients with poor liver function, ChILPU-B patients? How do you approach them?
One of the key factors is what's the pace of change? So a patient who's been ChILPU-B8 even, but has been so for 5 years, I'm much more comfortable giving that patient STRIDE or TEZOBEV than I am somebody who was ChILPU-A5 a week ago or 2 weeks ago and is now B8. 2 weeks later. That's much more worrisome that something is dynamically evolving. So pace of change is a critical factor. Evolving rapidly progressive portal hypertension, meaning dropping platelets, a big tumor thrombus in the main portal vein, new ascites are very worrisome that there's a dynamic process going on. And counsel the patient and family that this is a risky situation, that GI bleeding is on the horizon or other decompensation.
Stacy, what are your thoughts on the approach to systemic therapy for these patients who have borderline or poor hepatic function?
Yeah. So the truth is, most of the patients we see in clinic are not trial candidates. And over the years, the majority of the patients that I've taken care of have Child-Pugh B disease, and I routinely give them systemic therapy. I mean, I do think, to Katie's point, you know, you have to think about where the patient is on the trajectory. You know, do they have stable Child-Pugh B disease? It's been like that from before the tumor formed, or is this really tumor-driven, the decline? You know, are they kind of in a stable place? Is there a dynamic change going on? But the truth is, you know, we don't have, right, the trial data is typically Child-Pugh A and some B7s, and we're often extrapolating out, but we do that really in all of oncology, right? So I don't know why it became such a sticking point specifically in HCC to right. think about the Child-Pugh score when really we're constantly treating patients that were not necessarily fitting all the criteria, you know, of a child. And because of that, we removed some of that language out of the NCCN guidelines this past year, I think, for people to think more broadly about it. But I would say, you know, you have to think about each patient specifically, right, of where they are. But I would say routinely we treat patients that are, you know, Child-Pugh B. The C patients you have to really think right. about, because that's often, you know, they often, things are changing too fast to get benefit from treatment. There's some exceptions.
Anthony, you have thoughts there. What are your key variables that are deal breakers for you?
Yeah, even though I generally agree, I would caution that all Child-Pugh B patients are not equal, right?
And I think she did a nice job highlighting that, right? I mean, you know, if you're a five versus, I mean,
it's not just the numbers, right? It's also what's making you a B. Is it the albumin and the bilirubin, or is it somebody with recurrent ascites requiring paracentesis, active encephalopathy, those types of things? So that makes a difference. And the other nuance I would make, yes, we extrapolate and treat patients who are not trial candidates and other tumor types, but here, the degree of liver dysfunction is actually prognostic. It may affect their survival. So you have to decide, am I actually going to prolong the patient's survival by treating their cancer or not? And that's a tough decision. It requires experience, clinical acumen, et cetera. But it's something to keep in mind.
No, I think that's a great call out about, you know, trying to make an educated decision. All of those numbers don't necessarily equate to the same clinical outcomes.
Yeah, I would just add, and I think both of you touched on it, it's critical to look at the scan. Yeah. Right? Not just the report. I mean, we have drugs that have very high response rates, right? And if someone has a bilirubin of 4 and ascites, but their tumor, you know, they have a 15-centimeter tumor invading the portal vein, if that tumor gets smaller, they're going to do better. I mean, I use this term and I'll coin it. You know, in breast cancer, we use the term visceral crisis, right? That's not a reason not to treat these patients. We treat them because if they respond, they get better. And I think the same can apply here in HCC when you have a large tumor burden, right? Someone who's compensated and then decompensates and their scan shows this big tumor, that's someone who needs treatment and needs to respond quickly.
I think it's a bit of a blessing that we get to be here today and discuss in hepatocellular carcinoma that we have agents with great response rates, because that wasn't always the case, right?
For sure.
Our next clinical video, we'll go ahead and proceed with that now, Dr. Abrams and Dr. Abu Alfa.
You can find evidence of autoimmune disease in, you know, probably as many as 20% of patients. In general, I'll start these patients off with advanced disease with lenvatinib. Of the TKIs, lenvatinib is really well tolerated, but it has side effects. And surprisingly, low doses can, you know, remain quite effective. And the patient that I'm thinking of with Crohn's disease had been on lenvatinib for 2.5 years before there was clear signs of progression of disease. And I think ultimately we had been dosing him 4 milligrams a day and he'd been doing very well.
This is a very young person, hepatitis B, ultimately liver mass, developed with interestingly 10 over 10 bone pain in the sternum, real pain. Imaging showed a bone mass right here in the middle of the sternum. And the biopsy was positive for HCC. The colitis was already under poor control. And patient was on steroids, elected to start him on lenvatinib at 12 milligrams daily. The patient was noted to have lost some weight interstitial atherosclerotic lymphadenopathy. And so what do you do in that setting? We consider either change therapy because he's losing weight. And for example, you go to cabozantinib or reduce the dose. And dropping the dose from 12 milligram to 8 milligram did the job for the patient and added weight and did very well with clearly a response on imaging.
And what's his current situation?
It's still doing well. The bone mass, we still see it. We feel it. It's not like bothering in any way.
Okay. I know you guys have all been faced with this question. You know, how do you approach the therapy for patients with autoimmune disease and the role of immune checkpoint inhibitors? Anthony, you want to start that one?
Sure. I mean, I would agree with what's been proposed. If there's active autoimmune disease, TKI is the way to go. And currently, lenvatinib in first line has the best data. As a reminder from the modern phase 3 trials, right, whether it's the pembrolenva study comparing pembrolenva to lenvatinib or the nivo-ipi versus TKI, where the majority of patients got lenvatinib in the control arm, the median survival with lenvatinib is 19 to 20 months. So this is impressive activity, impressive data, and I think it's a great alternative for patients with active autoimmune disease.
Richard, does the LEAP data that came out bolster the support for lenvatinib here in the frontline setting for those with autoimmune disease? I mean,
there's autoimmune disease and there's autoimmune disease. You know, some people, you know, if it's very mild, if it's thyroid, things that can be controlled, you could still argue to give IO, but for someone with active Crohn's, we'd be cautious. But I think one of the most interesting things that came out of the LEAP-002 study, which was Len-Pembro versus Len, was how the performance of Len at 19 months, right, compared, and that's what made it a negative study, so to speak, because in the REFLEX study, survival with Len was like 14, 15 months. So somehow, in the modern age, and probably comfort with using it in patient selection, and repeatedly also in CheckMate 9DW, lenvatinib's giving 19-month survival and a very strong objective response rate. Again, consistently 18, 19% objective response, which, having been involved with this molecule since REFLECT, you know, the LEAP studies have and 9DW have confirmed that it's probably the best TKI we have in the space.
Ruth, does it matter on the STRIDE regimen if you add a CTLA-4 in an autoimmune? Does that give you more pause than a single immune checkpoint?
I think so. For autoimmune disease, if it's remote history, mild presentation, sometimes I would consider with caution. But if patient needs intervention, active intervention for autoimmune disease, I would stay away. But I think we try to extrapolate the data a little bit because you do see more immune-mediated AEs with the combinations. We do worry about doing the combination in those patients more than the single agent.
This question came in from the audience, Stacey. I mean, when we're treating these mm-hmm. folks with TACE and also with immune checkpoint inhibitors and TKIs, all of which can cause abnormal LFTs, and like, how do we parse out causative problem here, you know, in the practice of daily taking care of these patients? I know that's a trick question.
Yeah, no, I mean, so, you know, they get labs every time you see them, and you have to be checking labs frequently on these patients. And, you know, I think the more experience you have with different drugs and the procedures, you see that there's often these bumps and they come back down. And, you know, you really have to have a sense of the time frame, how they're feeling. You know, what I've noticed is that often when patients get local therapy, they don't necessarily have follow-up with that team. And so I think the medical oncologist, I've kind of taken over a lot of making sure that they have close follow-up before restarting therapy, you know, helping them with symptom management, and really following the labs. You know, there are often these small bumps, especially with TKIs, that you could treat through, but you do have to follow them closely. And especially, you know, like any oral treatment, you really need to educate patients and their caregivers about when to call.
Anthony, what are your thoughts on those transplant patients? Because obviously transplant plays a role in hepatocellular, but we see other solid organ transplants, right? Is this still just a hard no on any immune checkpoint inhibitor here?
In my opinion, yes. I mean, there is a real rejection rate. Now, if you reject the kidney, you can be on hemodialysis, right? But if you reject the liver, it's a much bigger problem.
Right.
And, you know, to the best of our ability, it looks like the rejection rate could be as high as 30%, and these could be really catastrophic events. So I think it's a hard no for liver transplant. For renal transplant, I think there is a risk-benefit discussion that has to happen.
Right. Difficult lifestyle decision.
Yeah.
Yes, Stacey.
You know, so every time this question comes up, the more I've thought about it, I think we have to flip the question and say, how are we picking patients for liver transplant? We do have clear criteria, but if we're being honest, we've all seen patients recur, and some of them really were outside of criteria on their explant. And so should we, knowing that we have treatment with fair response rates now, should we think about treating certain patients that are more high risk for recurrence with some treatment prior to their transplant and give them the benefit of seeing how they respond to immune therapy maybe before? That's a provocative question.
Really is.
So
yeah.
I'm just saying, though, I think it's something worth thinking about because it's really heartbreaking when you see people recur after transplant.
Got it. We're going to move on to module 3 now, but before we dive into Dr. Hees, that everyone with portal vein thrombus gets anticoagulation, yes or no? No.
Not routinely.
Not routinely. Okay, that was an audience question. I just wanted to clarify that. Okay, Dr. He, the floor is yours.
I think we have covered some of this topic. So what I'm going to talk about the current first-line therapy for advanced HCC. So I will provide some update on the iBrain 150 study and the 5-year survival data on the Himalaya study and some interesting subgroup analysis of patients enrolled in those trials and also talk about the TKI a little bit. So the follow-up of the initial report of iBrain 150 and there's another publication and two years ago, and with a median follow-up of close to 16 months. And you can see the benefit holds and with a hazard ratio of 0.66, and the two curves separate nicely. And now you also see the same, if you look at the progression-free survival, the hazard ratio is 0.65, the benefit is there. Then look at the response rate, 30% with 8% of CR rate compared to 11% from sorafenib and no CR. And the duration of response on the bev-atezo arm was 18 months. And so there's updated safety report and there's no surprises. And so I think the AEs have been consistent with the initial reports. So now the Himalaya investigators and published and presented the 5-year survival data of the Himalaya study. And this is so far the longest follow-up for global phase 3 study. So you can see the landmark analysis at 5 years, patients with advanced HCC has a survival rate close to 20% compared to the sorafenib arm, it's close to 10%. And now if you look at subgroup analysis, it's all, most of those four on the left side favor the straight regimen, combination of the durvalumab with tremelimumab. So safety, side effects of the treatment, and this is there's no surprise and it's consistent with the initial report. And so grade 3-4 AE, 12.6% versus 6.4%, quite well tolerated. If you, percentage of leading to discontinuation is only 5.7% on the straight regimen treated patients, 2.6% from the sorafenib treated arm. So now I think we've touched this from try to answer the audience questions. The selection, now we have two FDA-approved options supported by global phase 3, very positive phase 3 trials with good long-term follow-up. So now we want to now look at the patients enrolled in each study and we want to learn more from the subgroup analysis. How can we make this decision? So we start with the VP4. So iBrain 150 did include patients with VP4. So this is the VP4 definition. So tumor invasion tumor thrombus of the main portal vein or collateral left and right portal vein simultaneous involvement. And those are very poor prognostic factors. So they presented efficacy data in that subgroup of patients and safety data in that subgroup of patients. So the left side is the efficacy data, right side is the safety data. So the first two columns are patient with VP4. The right two columns are the rest of the intention to treat population. So first I want to see, to show you that this is a really poor prognostic factor. So if you look at the median survival, the first row, and it's for the Bev-Atezo-treated arm is only 7.6 months compared to 21 months in the rest of the population. But the benefit is there. So you can see the hazard ratio is 0.62 and very consistent with the initial report. Now, if you want to look at the safety data, and so so the VP4, if you look at the grade 3-4 AEs and like the general AE reports, they're very similar. But if you look at any grade variceal bleeding, 14% in patients with VP4 tumor invasion and versus 2% in the rest of the population. So most of the variceal bleeding in that study seems to occur in the patients with VP4 disease. So I think if patients with the VP4 disease, you really have to come to think about the risk and the benefit ratio. If those patients do benefit, you can see the hazard ratio. Of course, they also have increased bleeding risk. So another interesting development is the ALBI score. So when we talk about the Child-Pugh score, which is really designed to evaluate the risk of cirrhotic patient to go through abdominal surgery. So it's a very strong predictive, survival predictor. And so patients, when we enroll patients, and most patients focus on Child-Pugh A patient class patients. And so now there's another way to look at the liver function, which is the ALBI score, which there's this very complex. I have to use the MedCalc to do the calculation to figure out is this grade 1, grade 2, grade 3. But if you look at that Child-Pugh box, Child-Pugh A box, and the green line is the ALBI score. So not all Child-Pugh A patients have the equal amount of liver reserve, equal amount of liver dysfunction. So now both study have done subgroup analysis looking at the ALBI grade. So this is the Himalaya study. So on the left panel is ALBI grade 1. Those are better liver function. ALBI grade 2 or 3, which is on the right panel, and slightly worse liver function. So you can see that you do to see the benefit of the STRIDE regimen and in this subgroup analysis. And you know, IMbrave 150, there's a post hoc and exploratory analysis also use ALBI score, and you can see in the ALBI grade 1, the hazard ratio is 0.5. which is significant benefit. You see the two curves separate very nicely. But in the slightly worse liver function, ALBI grade 2, then the benefit gets smaller and you see the two curve overlap. Of course, we have to take this data with a grain of salt, and this is really exploratory analysis, subgroup analysis. But that sort of give us some thoughtful sort of data. And so now make selection. So usually in my practice, and I would consider the bleeding risk, recent varices bleeding, large varices. In my practice, if they're VP4, I get nervous of doing the Bev-Atezo, even there's benefit shown in the subgroup analysis. And so ALBI grade 2, I don't use as much, but sometimes I do plug it in and help me to sort of make the selection. But I do think the dynamics, the portal pressure dynamics makes a huge difference. And I think the rapid increase in the portal pressure, those of the patients tend to have bleeding risk. So TKI, I think Stacy is going to talk about that. I'm going to have to show you the very original data, the SHARP study that got sorafenib approval, Lenvima, lenvatinib got approved from the REFLEX study, which is a non-inferiority study. So it's those support the approval of both drugs. And it's interesting that I plot this. And so we have used sorafenib as the control arm for a long time. And then we started to use lenvatinib. pembrolizumab as a control arm, at least in two studies. You can see the control arm, it's performing better, improving. For the LiPo2 study, it's 19 months. For the 90W study, it's like close to 21 months. Of course, that's impacted probably also by second-line therapy. We'll feel more comfortable taking care of those patients and on TKI, and we also manage liver failure better. So it's a multifactorial contribution. And so this is this very like prior IO data I also have to show in patients who are not candidate for immunotherapy. TKI, like if you do sequential TKI, the survival sequential TKI add up together is like 26 months, and it's actually quite good data. And so I think in those patients, we have to really be very patient and provide good education and really work with them and to try to get them on the TKI. Now we have 4 TKIs we can use. So making decision, TKI versus immunotherapy, we touched upon this in the discussion, autoimmune disease, history of transplant, we talked about this. If patients prefer oral therapy and they live far away, it's harder for them to come, and we need a biomarker that would help us to make the selection.
Thank you. We did have a question from the audience, and I'll throw this up as a softball, whoever wants to tackle it. So the question that was asked was, can you discuss histotripsy and the role of this modality? So any takers? Doctor?
Well, look, this is a novel modality that has its potential advantages from a technical perspective. So it may be easier to deploy in places where there's a heat sink or next to the gallbladder, et cetera. And certainly I'm not an expert in that space. The problem, I think, the visibility of that therapy is way ahead of the data. And I think there's need for development of more safety data and efficacy data in different tumor types before it's applied so broadly. The problem is now every patient is asking about histotripsy without the data.
Great points. Thanks for tackling that. And great talk, Dr. He. That was really great, helping us parse through how we make decisions about a pathway. I love your slides, and Richard's slides too with the cartoon were great, looking at a visual impact of the tumor burden, really highlighting the prognosis. I think all of you guys have brought up a key point that I want to reiterate, which is that the prognosis of these patients is so heavily driven by the underlying liver disease from the get-go, right? And so I think it's critical. We're going to move on to vignette with Dr. Abrams, Kelly, and Dr. Abu Alpha.
As a first-line treatment for someone who is child A with advanced disease, how do you determine which of the two accepted first-line treatments to choose from? I don't think there's a lot of compelling evidence one way or the other to say that either regimen, atezo-bev or STRIDE, is, you know, better in one circumstance or another. I think the way we make these determinations in general are, can a patient receive Bev easily? You know, are there some contraindications or at least some comorbidities that make Bev less attractive? In general, I have been using more STRIDE of late. The reason being, I think it's easier. I think Bev tends to have a lot of side effects that you run into that make it a little bit more difficult over time, particularly with patients who have advanced cirrhosis. But I think that STRIDE is easier. There's no question about it. It has, you know, fewer visits. It's just less intense. So, you know, 6 1/2 dozen the other. I think for patients who are younger, want to be more aggressive, maybe atezo-bev has a slight advantage. For patients who are a little older, have more comorbidities, maybe more advanced liver disease, I think STRIDE is probably superior. And, you know, I think it's very interesting to ask the faculty how they make these determinations, you know, what their opinions of both regimens are and whether they have a strong preference one way or the other.
I choose between those two based on comorbidities in particular, those that are cardiovascular related, risk of blood clots, bleeding, stroke, and varices. They will favor STRIDE. Conversely, patients who have history of any kind of underlying autoimmune disease or who seem to have really only one shot on goal, like really impending deterioration if we don't get tumor control, I think those are the patients that we favor atezo-bev in.
If you remember, you are the first to ask me when we presented the data at the GI ASCO, you asked me, whom shall you give Durva-Tremi to? And I told it to everybody. This is still our standard of care therapy because number one, it's highly tolerated. Number two, we don't have to await and really stress people about waiting for an endoscopy. Number three, the responses from it are really robust.
Well, I think it's clear where his allegiances lie. So, all right, Stacy, for you, first of all, Dr. He, I thought, you brought up a great point about the survival at 0.7 months versus, you know, when you have that portal vein invasion. Are there clinical factors, Stacy, that would make, is it all B2? Is it, hey, this is a PV4, I choose, Durva-Tremi over Atezo-Bev? Is there something that sways you there? Is it purely comorbidity driven?
So a lot of it's comorbidity driven. I mean, I think the one thing that hasn't been brought up is what was the use of high dose steroids in these two studies. So it was about 10% for Atezo-Bev and 20% with Durva-Tremi. So I kind of look at each patient. So it's one more kind of consideration. I kind of think, what would happen if this person in front of me had to go on a course of high dose steroids or had a complication resulting in hospitalization?
And you're saying that steroids is mitigating side effects from the immune checkpoint?
Correct. Okay. Right. Right. So this was all for autoimmune side effects. So I think, that plays a role in it too. So I'm kind of surprised when people keep saying how it's better tolerated, because I wouldn't say it's better tolerated. I would say they both have their specific, ins and outs, but I wouldn't say that we have no direct comparison anyhow. So I don't know how you could really say it's definitely better tolerated. And there is a higher use of steroids. So it really, I think, comes down to each patient and their comorbidities.
Dr. Finn, you have thoughts there on how you decide?
Of course I have thoughts. We heard Dr. Ghassan's thoughts, so I will paint it a different way. I think you need to look at the data from these two studies, right? Median overall survival, 19.2 months versus 16.4 months with STRIDE versus IMbrave150. Ruth pointed out that 19.2 months is including patients with main portal vein, which is a very strong negative factor, and still it was 19.2 months. PFS improved with a hazard ratio of 0.66 with Atezo-Bev. You don't see any difference with Durva-Tremi and PFS. And perhaps most importantly to me, because survival in this disease now with IO is driven by response rates, right? And the objective response rate with Atezo-Bev is 30% compared to 20%. So for me, the issue is, why can't I give Atezo-Bev? And obviously it's going to be related to some Bev toxicity. Some of these have come up, but they're all level one positive phase three studies, but I don't think they're all equal.
Anthony, what are your thoughts here?
I'm usually the tiebreaker here. So I'll try to do that again. So I think I absolutely agree that both have positive data, but I do like Katie's point about one shot on goal. To Richard's point, the higher response rate, the PFS benefit with Atezo-Bev makes me lean towards that option in patients who may not be able to make it to a second line unless they get benefit in first line therapy. So if I'm worried about the tumor burden, the tempo of disease, etc., I want to go with that regimen first. If I'm not as worried and patient has comorbidities that worry me about usage of Bev, I'm very comfortable using Durva-Tremi because it has also level one evidence.
Ruth, would you use the Olvi grade 2 to decide between, if you have one shot on goal, would it make you nervous?
So I would want to understand what made that Olvi grade 2. And it's that really like stable cirrhotic cirrhosis versus rapid decline. And I don't think I've used it Olvi grade, I used it for a lot of trials. And but I don't think I've used it much in the clinical practice.
Thank you. All right, Katie has a new clinical vignette for you guys. Y'all are in the hot seat for 2 hours, so buckle up.
Any situations where you use an upfront IO alone? And if so, which IO, and any questions about that?
That's a great question. I don't think we have, there's certainly not great prospective data. I have used durvalumab and pembrolizumab and nivolumab all over the years, nivolumab before the FDA approval was rescinded. But in patients, particularly those with Child-Pugh B or very borderline liver function who have comorbidities that make us concerned for their tolerance of an immune-related adverse event for the case of a dual checkpoint inhibitor and synchronous comorbidities that make us anxious for their tolerance of a BEV-based toxicity, those are the patients that I use a single-agent checkpoint inhibitor. Patients where we just don't want to use any immune checkpoint inhibitor, that includes liver transplant patients who have recurrent HCC, I use lenvatinib.
All right. Thanks, Katie. Stacy, in what situation, if any, do you utilize a single-agent immune checkpoint inhibitor? And if so, do you have a preference based on the data that was outlined?
You know, it's rare now to not use combination therapy because if they're a candidate for immune therapy, then they should be a candidate for dual. But I would say, right, we had this gap in time where we didn't have approval of, you know, dual therapy and a lot of patients were on single agent. And I'm sure we all have examples of many patients who did very well for a long time, you know, on single agent therapy. It's just hard for me to think of a specific situation of why I wouldn't be able to give either doublet.
I've had occasions like patient has a history of autoimmune disease, but quiet. I'm kind of nervous, and then patient really couldn't tolerate TKI. And those patients, I would try single agent and test the water a little bit.
Can I ask a question about that, though? Then why not give BEV with it? Like if the question was autoimmune, you know,
but
it doesn't increase the...
You can't do combination, but, you know, usually those are patients with many other issues, comorbidities.
Anthony, what are your thoughts here?
So I do feel like, Katie, that patients with compromised liver function, we really don't have prospective safety data with the combination IOs. And it depends what's making their liver function worse. As Richard said, if it's tumor burden, they're otherwise in good shape, and there's no ascites encephalopathy, I may give them combination to try to downstage the disease and improve their liver function. But if it's otherwise really underlying synthetic dysfunction, we have some prospective safety data with nivolumab in Child-Pugh B. Otherwise, the other trials in Child-Pugh B are still ongoing. We don't know that giving combination therapy is going to improve survival in Child-Pugh B more than single agent. And the single agent data has been very consistent across trials. Remember, there was a non-inferiority study with tislelizumab, I believe, that was against sorafenib. Durvalumab, non-inferior to sorafenib. And the Nevo data has been very consistent. So I do use it in those patients with some compromise of liver function where I don't feel comfortable with the combination.
Got it. What are your thoughts, Dr. Finn? Here, is there something, I mean, do you consider the one dose of priming, trimi, and the stride to be that distinct from single agent immune checkpoint inhibitor?
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, because we know that single agent durva doesn't improve survival versus the control arm, and that single dose of trimi does. I mean, you can't argue that fact. The response rate goes up and toxicity goes up, right? And again, manageable toxicity, but clearly there's a biological effect with that single dose. I mean, to answer the question about do I ever use single agent IO, and yeah, I think it's the patient who, I don't know if I really want to treat them at all, but it's a little hard to say, or they don't want to hear just straight out the door, you know, hospice, and, you know, it's one dose, you know, Nevo's once a month, Pembro's every 3 weeks. And, you know, if they have a response quickly, then you save the day. But you probably won't do too much harm in those patients.
All right, Dr. Abrams has another video question for you guys. Thanks for your candid responses there.
If you have a patient with discordant tumor markers, say a very high CA19-9 and a normal AFP, but the radiographic criteria are very consistent with HCC, what would you do in that situation? The American Society of Liver Diseases is okay with just going by radiographic criteria, but medical oncologists, I think we want to, you know, make sure that this is actually the diagnosis because we're the ones administering the treatments. They could have an element of cholangiocarcinoma, and without a biopsy, you're not going to know that. We see mixed tumors, you know, not frequently, but they're out there more frequently than you may suspect. And clearly the treatments are so radically different. In general, what I do when I see them is I treat it as a cholangiocarcinoma first because, you know, these days you have chemo plus immunotherapy. So ideally, it seems like you're kind of covering both by treating it with GemCis durvalumab or GemCis pembrolizumab. And GemCis, there's a literature that in HCC may not be the greatest regimen, but it does something. There's no great way to do it. It's difficult. And if something's not working, you may flip the script and go to an HCC regimen afterward.
So I think this is super common in clinical practice, at least for me. We see this a lot where histology says one, but perhaps AFP or CA19-9 level says something different, and perhaps the clinical course doesn't fit with your thoughts. But I think as a provider, it's a conundrum. I have multiple questions from the audience and the Zoom asking this same question. What do we do with this? You know, is this a tumor heterogeneity? So love to hear you guys' response to his thoughts about how he would begin with the cholangio-based regimen because there's an immune checkpoint inhibitor there and pivot subsequently. What are your thoughts, Dr. El-Khoueiry?
Generally, I would follow the same approach for these mixed tumors. Is start with the GemCis plus IO, thinking I'm covering both. But you know, this is really a separate biologic entity, and it's still poorly understood. And I think what we're seeing in practice when we treat these patients, and some are behaving more like cholangio, some are behaving more like HCC, and some do poorly no matter what you do. So I think there needs to be more understanding, but I like the comment that you kind of adjust as you go. Recently, I just saw a patient actually who's had regimens treating both because it has a mixed tumor and only responded to the HCC regimens and not to the chemo. So now I'm convinced that this is more behaving like HCC. So sometimes you have to figure it out as you go along.
Right.
A quick comment. I'm not a fan of tumor markers. I think it's one of the worst inventions in oncology at this point. And both are very nonspecific. Both can go up with any liver-occupying lesion, both AFP and CA19-9. So when there is a question about the radiologic diagnosis, a biopsy should be done.
That was, you answered one of the questions from the audience was, you know, would you ever proceed without tissue, you know, in this situation, but a biopsy would be great. Dr. Finn, can you comment or elaborate a little bit more on what your thoughts would be on how you would manage a patient? When would you maybe pivot to a TKI if a combination chemotherapy and immunotherapy wasn't working there?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, giving a patient the diagnosis of cholangiocarcinoma isn't doing them a big favor, right. You know, especially if they don't have a molecular marker, right? I mean, nowadays, the prognosis for HCC, stage for stage, is better. So, you know, I agree with Anthony, tumor markers aren't going to decide your treatment. It's going to be, you know, histology, and again, whether you start with an HCC regimen or chemotherapy, IO, at progression, you'd probably switch. Now, you're talking maybe third line, right? Do I go back to chemotherapy or do I go to something like Lenvima, lenvatinib, because I feel it's an HCC, and I might stay down the HCC course. I mean, there is actually data, an NCCN listed, I'm pretty sure Len Pembro has a NCCN listing for cholangiocarcinoma, you know, low-level evidence, and that might be something to consider, right? If they progressed on GemCis Pembro, then you do a Tezobev, and they're progressing, you know, Len Pembro might be something to consider.
Quickly, Ruth, you know, this question about underlying histology, you know, Richard brought up a great point, you know, for the cholangio patients, FGFR matters a lot. In HCC, we don't have a lot of guidance there. Should we be routinely sending all these patients for NGS or some other biomarker testing, understanding the failure of the tumor markers to guide our decisions?
For all mixed HCC cholangio, I do that. For cholangio, I do that. And for HCC, so far, I have not done it.
Stacey, you have thoughts there?
I think we need to biopsy more patients, especially when there's, you know, right, when there's mixed evidence. And it's, you know, I agree that tumor markers are not great, but it is hard when you have another high tumor marker to not get a biopsy, especially if the, you know, if the radiographic evidence is incomplete and might be mixed tumor. And then I think we definitely have to do NGS testing if there's any cholangio. Sometimes you could get the pathologist to kind of go in one direction or the other, but that's often a hard position to put them in.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have a point I want to make. So sometimes you biopsy it, it's HCC, yep. But the image is LI-RAD-M, and CA99 is elevated. So in those cases, I do try the Viomap GemCis, and as one of the lines of therapy, and try it out, and sometimes it works. The problem is people with cirrhosis, and they tend not to tolerate chemo for long. So right. You can only try it for a short course.
Thank you. Okay, Stacy, you're going to bring us home with a discussion about sequencing of these therapies for recurrent patients.
So hang in there. We're almost to the end. So first, we're going to talk about some promising other first-line strategies, and then we're going to talk about selection and sequencing. So I just wanted to mention first the CheckMate 90W study. So this was based on, and we'll discuss in a minute, the 040 study that looked at the Ipi-Nivo combination in second line. And so based on the response data in that study, this was a first-line study versus lenvatinib or sorafenib. And so, you know, we see that there is a separation of the curves at 24 months and 36 months here with a median overall survival difference of 20.6 months versus 23.7. I think, you know, the bigger discussion is really where does this fit in then into first-line therapy, given the discussion that we just had of the other two regimens. So this is another CTLA-4 combination, and we're not discussing the toxicity data, but I think, you know, for maybe future discussion, right, we have to delve into more where this would fit in terms of response rate and toxicity, et cetera, but something to think about in the future. And then we also have the CARES 310 study. That was the combination of camrelizumab and rivosertinib versus sorafenib as first-line therapy. So this is an anti-PD-1 antibody with a TKI combination. And so, you know, we see here that the median progression-free survival was from 3.7 months to 5.6, and the median overall survival improved from 15.2 months to 22.1. But I think importantly, you know, you have to look closely at the adverse events. So for any treatment-related adverse event for this combination, 10% of the patients had a grade 4 event, and 71% of the patients had a grade 3 event, although on sorafenib, you know, these numbers were also pretty high at 48% with a grade 3 event. So I think, you know, when you have the first treatment available for combination therapy with HCC, it's very exciting, and we learn to manage the side effects, and then now we have two regimens to pick from. And I think as the field gets busier, right, then we really have to parse the data out for each of these regimens in comparison to say what should actually be considered first line. And when something is the third or fourth trial, right, to enter the field, then you have to say, is there a compelling reason why we would use this as opposed to what we already have? So I think I'll leave it there, but, you know, regimens to kind of think about in the future. So we'll move on to thinking about TKIs and relapse disease. We did discuss already a little bit about sorafenib, or mostly lenvatinib now, used in the first line in select cases, especially patients maybe that recurred after transplant or have a significant autoimmune disease. But, you know, now often, even though this was first line data, right, we often move it just sequentially. So going back to the original data here of sorafenib versus placebo, you know, we had a small survival benefit. And then the lenvatinib study versus sorafenib was a non-inferiority study. But based on the side effect profile, this really became the TKI that's often used first. So, you know, when we think about tyrosine kinase inhibitors, are they really all the same? No, they do have different targets, right? And they're all kind of dirty in that they have multiple targets for each of them. They all target VEGF, right? But then as you could see, they have other other targets as well. And that does play into the myriad of side effects that, you know, that patients have and slightly maybe different responses in different patients. So, you know, these studies were all done in the setting before immunotherapy. So they were single, they were studies that were single agent versus placebo in second line after sorafenib progression or intolerance. And, you know, basically, they all showed a small survival benefit. So the RESOURCE study looked at regorafenib, Celestial with cabozantinib, and then the REACH2 study looked at ramucirumab, which is an anti-VEGF2 antibody. The original REACH study did not have an AFP cutoff and was a negative study, but it seemed like there was maybe a population from that first study with a higher AFP that may have benefited. So the second study was done looking at only patients with an AFP greater than 400, and then we were able to see, you know, a small survival benefit in that population. So, you know, I think what's hard about the second line is that these studies are never going to be reproduced, right, looking at them sequentially after the first line therapies that we have. And I would argue that it's probably not the best use of all of our resources, right, and to, you know, to do those studies. So we're often left kind of extrapolating out, right, what do we do, you know, after after initial therapy. We do know that the TKIs certainly have adverse events. And how I often describe this to patients is, you know, these are often side effects that don't necessarily put someone in the hospital, right? But they can make you quite uncomfortable and symptomatic. So they're the chronic kind of grade two side effects. And so often in oncology, if something is only grade two, we often don't even include it in a discussion of the trial, right? It's often just excluded from discussion. But I would argue that if you read through this list and you had fatigue, weight loss, nausea, diarrhea, possibly hand-foot syndrome, hypertension, and some of these other side effects, you would really not be feeling well. You wouldn't feel up to coming to this event this evening, and it would certainly be affecting your life. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, right, we know, we didn't discuss this data earlier this evening, but we know that in the first line studies, we looked at time to deterioration, right? We looked at patients' quality of life and symptom burden, and patients felt better on combination immunotherapy than they did on TKIs. So it's really something to think about, especially when patients are going into second or subsequent lines of therapy. They often have a higher symptom burden. Sometimes their liver function has changed, right? And so this becomes very important to kind of, you know, factor into decision making. Then we have the CheckMate 040 study of the combination of nivolumab and ipilimumab. So this kind of followed more of the traditional melanoma regimen, right, of using four doses of ipilimumab, which then the Himalaya study, you know, changed to just give a single priming dose. And so what we saw in this combination is overall response rates in the, you know, over 30% with, you know, a median duration of response of between 16, 17 to 22 months. And so, you know, this is also another option, although we don't often think of this as second line, given that in this study, right, these were all patients that had received sorafenib, and most patients are only receiving a TKI in the first line if they're really not candidates for immunotherapy. So we don't see a lot of patients receiving this, you know, this kind of sequence of therapy. It does leave the question open, you know, in general about sequencing, because we don't really know if someone's received atezo-bev, right, would there be benefit of adding in a CTLA-4 antibody at some point? I think we all wish that we could kind of give one of each class of drugs at the same time, like as a first-line therapy, right? But that's not an option. So I think, you know, this study was important. It definitely set the groundwork for thinking of CTLA-4 combination. And now we have the first line data that we had just discussed. And here we see, you know, the safety data, which has, you know, significant number of grade 3-4 events, especially in the IPI-3 dosing. So how do we really think about second-line therapy? If patients have good performance status and progression on immunotherapy, I liked this graphic because I think it highlights a couple of important points. You know, progression is not the same for all patients, and so we have to think about, did they have a significant adverse event from the immunotherapy or not? How long, were they on that regimen? And especially for the one on the right, we often think about patients that just have oligo progression, especially after being on a first-line therapy for a long time, of bringing them back to multidisciplinary discussion and thinking about local regional therapy for some of these patients. I think that's really important. But then, we have to think about, right, do we move to a TKI? How do we sequence? I would say most people start with lenvatinib and then they move to either cabozantinib or regorafenib and then to the subsequent drug after that. I'm curious to hear how much ramucirumab other people use. I think overall the use of it is fairly low. So given that we don't have trial data, right, then we go to the next best thing, which is real-world data. So this was just one study that looked at real-world data of second-line therapy, and they looked at a little over 400 patients who had progression of disease on atezo-bev, and turned out almost half of those patients received best supportive care. So when we were talking earlier about, one shot on goal, I guess you could say that really it's quite a large number of patients that don't wind up for one reason or another getting second line therapy. We don't know all the reasons from this study. But then about half of the patients went on to receive future treatment, and 155 patients went on to get a TKI, but 45 patients did receive more IO therapy, although we don't have all the reasons for that either. The median progression, free survival of all the patients was about 6 months. And we did see that there was better progression-free survival with the absence of portal vein thrombus, better performance status, right, and active treatment, which are not surprises. And there clearly was a better progression-free survival on treatment versus best supportive care. And interestingly, patients that received, I think my PowerPoint corrected PFS to changed it. But patients receiving TKIs versus IO had shorter, survival. I think it's very hard to say, though, what that really means, because clearly, there were reasons why certain patients went back on IO. And this was not prospective, right? This is just real-world data. And so I don't know that you could say it means everyone should be going back on IO, right? I think, that was only a small group of these patients. So I think you have to kind of know more about why someone chose to put those patients back on IO, but it does show, I think, that for some patients, right, that could be the right decision. So I just wanted to end with mentioning the IMbrave 251 study, and hopefully this will help us think a little bit more about whether we should be continuing IO in the second line. So this is a study of atezolizumab with either lenvatinib or sorafenib versus lenvatinib or sorafenib alone after progression on atezo-bev with a primary outcome of overall survival. So hopefully in the future we will have some randomized data that will help us with making this decision.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Stacey. And quite a call out. It looks like just a hair over half the patients really get more than one shot on goal, right? And so your last slide leads us into these video questions for you guys.
One question for faculty is if they have a preference in the post-atezo-bev, whether to use lenvatinib versus cabozantinib as their second-line agent. I think they're both very reasonable choices. I tend to, again, make the decision based on, does the patient have a lot of proteinuria or toxicities that might be exacerbated by lenvatinib more so than cabozantinib, versus does the patient have diarrhea or more skin toxicity that I worry will be worse with cabozantinib.
What about dosing and management of side effects of lenvatinib?
I often will start patients who are frail or I think are vulnerable to toxicity at one dose level lower. So if they are greater than 60 kilograms, I'll start them at 8 milligrams instead of 12, or if they're less than 60, I'll start them at 4 instead of 8, and then titrate upwards after 1 to 2, usually after a month if they're doing well. I'd be curious to hear if others do that. We also make sure that patients have a home blood pressure cuff, and usually the week before they get their lenvatinib in the mail, I tell them, start taking your blood pressure, start practicing, writing it down, send us your baseline measurements, just so we can practice making sure that they know how to read it, that the cuff works for them. One other point that is important for lenvatinib is monitoring QTC prolongation and making sure patients know to not use their Zofran. Occasionally, we can have a really exceptional response to tyrosine kinase inhibitors. I have a hepatitis B virus positive, multifocal and metastatic HCC patient who had progressed on sorafenib, then nivolumab. This was back in 2020. I put him on lenvatinib and kept him on lenvatinib for about 3 years because he had a rib tumor and some liver tumors. During that time, completely receded, and an AFP that was in the thousands receded to less than 2. He has had one local recurrence that we treated with TACE since then, but his other metastatic sites remain quiescent. And I don't know if this is a pure lenvatinib effect or if it was lenvatinib in the microenvironment of nivolumab, which he had just stopped due to progression. In any case, it's a very happy case to take care of.
Thanks, Katie. Okay. Ruth, what are your thoughts about this data from the 90W study that was mentioned? And as you comment about that, can you comment about the dosing of the IPI here, right? Because I think there are a lot of parallels we're beginning to see with HCC and renal cell carcinoma. There's sort of no original human thought. Sometimes those are carried over, but the dosing is different, right, on the IPI.
So the CheckMate 90W dosing is the same dosing for melanoma. And I think it was picked from the CheckMate 040 study because it provided the best survival. And we participated in the CheckMate 90W, so we have many patients we enrolled. And we have patients in CR, like after 2 years, and they're in CR, just come to see me twice a year. So it is a very active combination, but of course there's potential toxicities and we also have to be very cautious about.
What do you think about the combination data that we saw from the CARE study? Dr. Finn, you have any thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very active regimen. I mean, because they did allow patients with main portal vein. They still had this, survival of, I think, 22, 23 months. Objective response rate was in the mid-20s. Toxicity, as was called out, is an issue. I mean, grade 3, 4 together is over 80%, right? Still, we don't have approval in the U.S. because of some manufacturing issues, but presumably those can be overcome, and it will be another option in the mix, but clearly very active.
I think March, April, we discussed this earlier, in the spring perhaps for the repeat approval for those drugs with the FDA.
I'm not sure.
Okay. Anthony, you have thoughts here on what you would consider factors in selecting patients for who may have disease progression in their first line?
So progression first line on an IO-based combination, my favorite approach is to go to a tyrosine kinase inhibitor in second line. Now, can I really rationally choose between lenvatinib or cabozantinib or whatever? No, I cannot. I mean, so I tend to use lenvatinib because for simplistic reasons. It's just kind of sequencing the agents, and it gives me more options. So I start with lenvatinib, then I can go to cabozantinib or regorafenib and try to continue to sequence them. I do agree that there are occasional patients where I do worry about, lenvatinib is a more potent VEGF inhibitor, so there is more VEGF-related toxicities, whether it's hypertension, proteinuria, etc. So if I worry about that, I may gravitate more towards cabozantinib, but otherwise I try to sequence them in that order. There is emerging real-world data about using another IO. So if you start with atezo-bev, bringing back a CTLA-4 in third line like nivo-ipi, but these are small experiences, etc. So we'll see if more prospective data comes out, which I think it will. So that'll be important to see.
Ruth, a Quick question for you. This came from the audience and was brought up earlier with the issue of proteinuria with Lynn versus Bev versus some of the others. Do you distinguish those agents maybe in a patient who has some pre-existing proteinuria versus?
Yeah. All those, for those agents you just mentioned, I always get the baseline UA. I follow the UA. And then if it's, it becomes 100, 2 plus, then I start to do 24-hour urine collection. And then if it's really reaches grade 3, then I will stop. And so I think we have to be very careful with the proteinuria, especially elderly folks. They already have hypertension, diabetes, and so they have some baseline proteinuria. And so it's a side effect that we have to keep eye on.
Okay. We mentioned some sequencing. We're now going to get a new video with a question about rapid progression after atezobev.
What about your 73-year-old patient with lung and adrenal mets you treated with STRIDE after progressing on atezobev?
The outcome from atezobev with MAB is rather pretty robust and does very well. But sadly here, patient did progress right away. First imaging, barely 2 months of therapy, progression of disease. And the question is, what shall we do now? Switch to lenvatinib and say, you know what, checkpointers don't work for this patient, or switch to another checkpoint inhibitor? When we see a patient with that rapid progression of disease, despite a very robust effort that was done appropriately by the book, the chance for anti-drug antibody, which can occur in 30% of the patients on atezolizumab or receiving atezolizumab, can occur. And that's why the question was brought up, should we move on to lenvatinib as a tyrosine inhibitor, or shall we consider that there was anti-drug antibody for the atezolizumab, let's switch to another checkpoint, it was only for the heck of it to make sure the patient gets on a benefit from the checkpoint inhibitor. And exactly what happened, the patient already is at 5-year anniversary.
Okay, tough question, right? So in clinical practice, right, we may get thrown under the bus for sequential IO therapy there, but he obviously brings up a good point. How often, Richard, do you see antibodies to the drug itself, and is that playing a role here?
Yeah. So that's often talked about, but there's no prospective data and there's no clinical tests to look for antibody-drug antibodies. I think the more practical question is a patient who progresses on frontline IO has a very bad prognosis, right? Someone who gets no benefit, their survival is 8 months or less. And the question is, can we salvage those patients? And for me, a patient who got atezobev and is rapidly progressing, I would probably give them ipi-nivo, to be honest, right? Different mechanism of action, not an antibody, drug antibody issue, but just the mechanism, CTLA-4, IO versus, IO VEGF. And like Ghassan describes, I mean, I've had patients who've had dramatic responses. And I think now with the CARES data and the LEAP data, I tend to think of these as IO VEGF, IO-IO, and IO-TKI. And there's probably some overlap between them who responds, but I think there's probably distinct groups that benefit from either one, and it's up to us to figure out how to identify them.
Stacey, I knew this case was in here. That's why I had to ask the pseudo-progression question earlier, and you guys emphatically said no. But what are your thoughts about this unique case?
It's tough when patients just go right through first line therapy. But I think to Richard's point, thinking about ipi-nivo in this patient population could be reasonable. It's hard to know. I mean, we don't really have good data for that. I think sometimes with rapid progression, obviously you really have to see if the patient is still a good candidate for therapy, what their liver function is, what their performance status is, because often when things decline quickly, there's a global decline.
Great. Ruth, I guess as we think about, you shouldn't necessarily be pigeonholed perhaps into, immunotherapy and TKI-only therapy, right? I mean, maybe there are instances where adding a CTLA-4 makes the difference, maybe the addition of some local therapy, et cetera. You comment what your thoughts about that unique case were, and obviously in hindsight, he made a great decision, but, what contributed to that, and if you had to play those cards again?
Yeah, I think now we have a lot of options, and I want to share with you some real cases I had. So a patient progressed on bevacizumab. I switched to a TKI. Couldn't tolerate TKI very well, then progressed. And then I said, well, let's try the CTLA-4 PD. So I tried Nivo-EB. And then patient had severe colitis and was in the hospital, and we struggled, and patient survived. And then patient has no disease progression for a whole year. And then start to have disease recurrence. And then so my fellow asked me, do you want to ever go back to immunotherapy after what has happened? I say, no, no way. And then, so like the third year, patients started to progress, which had to do a little bit of ablation, still not able to control the disease. Then the Himalaya data came out, and I say, well, this is not, this CTLA-4 PD-L1, its side effect profile is different. The incidence is lower. Let's try this one. And of course, he went into colitis again. I saved, sort of get him out of it. Then now he's disease-free. And now this is like towards the 12 months, and he's still disease-free. He's off therapy. So you can see there are a lot of things we need to learn. I think we need to work with patients. I do believe those patients who progressed on one type of IO combination may respond. But you can see my sequence is I try TKI first.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's tough what you guys have to deal with every day. I want to get one last video in from Dr. Abrams about supportive care measures, as you mentioned, managing these side effects.
I think it would be very valuable to talk about the HCC patient who has a rapidly dropping albumin and is developing ascites. You know, this is a problem that is often difficult to manage. You know, we wrestle with when to place a Plurex catheter, how often they should be having paracentesis, what is the right way to put patients on diuretics. All of these things are difficult and I think really need to be co-managed by hepatology. But I would certainly ask the faculty how they manage refractory ascites in a patient with HCC. This is not, you know, the same thing as malignant ascites. Most of the time, it's ascites from just worsening cirrhosis.
Anthony, you want to take that one?
Well, this is one of the biggest challenges in the clinical setting. To me, it's an ominous sign if this happens in patients with advanced HCC. It's really a poor prognostic marker. And I really start to think at that point, should they really continue anti-cancer therapy or not? I would say most of the time I would stop it if they're requiring frequent paracentesis, because I don't know what the benefit at that point would be. But as was mentioned, it's diuretics, it's potentially Plurax catheter, co-management with hepatology, but really it's a very challenging clinical situation.
Yeah, go ahead, Ruth.
If cancer is under control, I do TIPS, and that actually helps in some patients. If the cancer is not under control, of course, I try to stay away from it.
Stacy, you want to comment on this? Is a question that came in from the audience. It's sort of sequencing and timing and of treating the underlying disease in some cases. And do you think that changes prognosis? Is this NASH versus is this Hep B, Hep C?
Yeah. So does the underlying etiology change the treatment decisions in terms of no? So, you know, there's really...
And then also, what would the timing be if you had to treat the hepatitis?
Yeah, so, you know, all patients with Hep B should be on suppressive therapy. You know, often a lot of people with Hep C have already received treatment, right? But now they have, you know, cirrhosis and developed cancer. Typically, if someone has advanced disease that they're going on systemic therapy, we don't go and treat the underlying, you know, Hep C. Certainly, you know, with alcohol, we're trying for abstinence, you know, which we don't always completely get. And then, you know, with metabolic disease, we're always working to have, you know, those factors under as good control, right, as we can. But I think in general, in this patient population, you know, we work with the person in front of us, right? And wherever things are, that's how we try to treat. But the better we could have those things under control. And so the third question that was on this list is the hepatologist helpful? Always.
Always.
You know, so sometimes patients, especially if you're not doing clinic together, they don't like having a separate appointment and they say, why do I need that? And I tell them, you need it.
I'd like to thank all of you guys. I think it's been a wonderful discussion. I appreciate your time and expertise. And I hope you enjoyed that research to practice regarding hepatocellular cancer tonight. Thank you.
Thank you.